Hello, Cyclocross friends, and thanks for tuning in to episode 183 of Cyclocross Radio. On today's show, we have Zach Dabb and Terry Buchanan of Low Pressure Promotions and MFG Cyclocross, and also Tacoma Nationals in 2019. Two of the guys behind that production and a lot of the racing that goes on in the Seattle-Tacoma area. And really just wanted to catch up on everything that they've done for cyclocross. And it was a fun conversation, and we're going to get right into it after I tell you about the sponsor for this episode, which is Works. And they want you to gear up for the racing season because it's going to happen. It may not be as soon as we like, but someday we're going to be out there racing again. Works wants to make sure that you are prepared. They have a whole slew of tools that may not help you directly with racing, but can help you get your bike clean with the Hydra Shot. They got these cool tables out there. They have these clipping tools and grinding tools and everything else, and their PowerShare battery that goes from one tool to the next. It's amazing stuff. I love it. I got a whole like stack of it in my garage that I've been using on this downtime, and I want you to do the same. If you use the code Gear Up, GEARUP, Gear Up, you'll get 15% off of your entire Works order at the website yourcleanbike.com. That website based on the Hydra Shot, which is just a must-have item. So get that and then throw all the rest of the stuff in your shopping cart as well. yourcleanbike.com. Use the code Gear Up, GEARUP, at checkout. You'll get 15% off, courtesy of the Wide Angle Podium Network. Speaking of which, go to wideanglepodium.com. Check out the new website. All of our shows are doing some great work. The Slow Ride Podcasts are putting on like old-timey radio shows, teleplays. We got Bike Shop CX. They're doing their April CX Challenge, which you should check out on Instagram. I've been participating in that. It's been a lot of fun. Over on Strava, we have the Wide Angle Podium Strava Club. Just a lot going on. Wideanglepodium.com. Would love to have you part of the community that makes up that network. And talking about strong communities, we're talking to Terry and Zach, and we're doing that right now. All right, Zach and Terry, thanks for joining me today. As I've been doing this entire month, is talking to people and really trying to kind of look not as much to the future, but a little bit in the past, get some cool stories. So it's great to speak to you all, especially after Nationals last year and everything you've done through MFG Racing. And, you know, the intent of that was not to give people kind of a break from reality and what's going on in the country and also the world, but especially from where you all are. I think we gotta at least address it. And I'll start with you, Terry. Just y'all are in the Seattle area, and what's going on, and how everybody's holding up.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, I appreciate you having us on. Zach lives in Seattle full time. I live in Seattle part time, and I'm lucky enough to live in a small town in the North Cascades. For part-time, that's where my family is based out of. So I've been basically, since our governor issued our stay home, stay healthy, I've been lucky enough to live in a town of like less than 4,000 people. So that's been a lot more easy for me. So Zach can probably talk a little bit more about the ghost town that is Seattle. But yeah, and then just being a business owner and all that, it's because bike racing promotion is not the primary way we make a living. That's been a scramble, and we've been having to take on a lot of stuff that way. We've been lucky because we service the low-income housing market, and so we've been deemed as essential workforce, and so we've been scrambling just to run our job sites in a safe way. So that's been super stressful over the last 2 weeks.
Yeah,
but
I'm sure.
You know, things are going well, but I think Zach can probably talk more about the epicenter of Seattle in terms of the ghost town that is kind of existing.
Zach, how's it going?
Yeah, it's certainly weird here. It was Sunday. It was the first time I was actually on I-5 in like 3 weeks, and it's just eerie. Like it's light out, so it's middle of the day, and no one's on the highway. And yeah, it just feels weird. Walking on the sidewalk feels weird. It's like you do this little shuffle dance when you see people. Like, are you going to go this way? Am I going to go this way? oh, you're an asshole runner. Oh, you're not going to get out of my way.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, but I think everyone's trying to do the best they can. I've been seeing a lot of really cool creativity in the restaurant industry. We have a couple restaurants around the corner that are just making food for the restaurant industry themselves. Like, hey, dinner's at 5 to 7. If you need it, come and get it. And that's been really cool to see.
Yeah, that is pretty awesome. Those are the kind of good stories you like to hear. But yeah, now I know from my neighborhood in DC, you know, I take my dog out every morning and knew that there were dogs in the neighborhood. I did not know there were so many dogs in the neighborhood until like the last week or so, where it's definitely, you know, you're like going 15 feet, crossing the other side of the road, letting them pass and cross them back. It's just, constant. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. I mean, going to the grocery store is definitely the most stressful thing. It's like, you know, you're confined spaces and you want to do the right thing. And like, it's crazy. Our grocery store and where we lived is like, most of the people who live or work there are like over the age of 60. So you feel like really like horrible, like having them check you out and stuff. So it's been a really crazy experience.
Yeah.
I mean, the closest thing that I remember to this kind of feel is just like holding the whole 9/11 post 9/11 thing. Sure. So it's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, when we do this again in a couple of years, we can come back and talk about this time. But for now, what I'd love to know is just more about the scene out there, and especially, you know, even starting from Starcross and the USGP stuff, or even if it started before that and MFG, and really just how you all got started in wanting to promote bike races and really sort of grow this scene.
Yeah. Well, I was involved with a pretty vibrant club here in the Seattle area, Lake Washington Velo, and we were putting on road races. Basically, because at that time, to be a sponsored club, you had an obligation to put on an event, and we kind of grew from that and would put on a number of events a year, and we got, you know, good at it. I was really enjoying that. And then we didn't really have a signature event in the Northwest that was at the pro level for like cross or mountain biking or road racing or that kind of thing. And Johnny Sunt was on the team at that time, and we had a group of riders that were traveling and going to NRC events and that kind of stuff. And we were at Nationals in Nashville, and Johnny and I were just talking about this lack of, you know, like not having a cool crit or something. And suddenly we both like kind of looked at each other almost simultaneously and say, nighttime cross race. And then it was like, yeah, this will work. We have Marymore, we have a velodrome, it's all lit up. We've had practices there forever. And so that's how Starcross got started. And then we built that from a, you know, couple of years. It's just a cool, fun grassroots event to UCI event. And that was, you know, an awesome event. It was super spectator friendly, great vibe. And then Zach came in and announced one year to help out when he moved out from Boston. And I got to know Zach through that. And then I get this email from Zach in 2008, I believe. And it's saying, dude, you got to go look at the local forum on cyclocross. There's all this really bad vibe going on. And like, we basically had this series that was put on by a group of volunteers, and they were having some issues with losing some venues and having to repeat races, you know, during the season at the same venue. And people were complaining like, we don't want to go back there again. And then the response is like, this is a volunteer organization. You guys just should be lucky to have racing. And so I was like, it'd be awesome if we could have like a series where customers are customers and the people who sell the stuff are the people who sell the stuff. And since you give people money and they're a professional organization, you have every right in the world to criticize them. And he says, Terry, you should put a cross series on. And I was like, dude, no, you have to help me. So basically, out of that whole email exchange and approval from my wife, we started MFG Cyclocross in 2009.
Nice. And that's, I think that's
approach to try to be customer centric, you know, and do something a little different.
You know, that was our approach. We're building out the Mid-Atlantic scene. It's like, okay, we want to keep that like grassroots vibe, but with professional production and sort of like match those two together. So the same thing. So, you know, people are going to pay you, you are going to give them what they expected. They're going to get the right, you know, scoring and all that kind of stuff. Yet still it's not going to be. Yeah. So Zach, starting off, you know, East Coast, I'm assuming since you're a founding member of HUP United, you were into cyclocross on the East Coast, and then moving out to the West Coast, that had to be a little bit of a culture shock, especially in the bike racing scene.
Yeah, it felt more similar than different. I lived in Seattle before I moved out to Boston, so I'd spent some time here and raced at North SeaTac, was my first race. Spent some time like around, you know, the era of Dale Knapp and Ann and all those folks from the Seattle area who were trying to go to Europe and race. But yeah, getting to Boston, there's just something about New England and the scene there that it's kind of hard to describe if you've only seen it from afar, been there a couple times. But it definitely was where I caught the cyclocross bug and had a lot of great people who had been promoting cross forever, and just characters of cross, right? And historic venues, Gloucester and Plymouth and Adams Race in NoHo.
Hampton, yeah.
Yeah, and so just had a really great experience racing and traveling all over the New England to do the Verge series. I mean, it was just the Verge series. And just surprised how many people would drive hours to just race. I mean, in the Mid-Atlantic, I'm sure it's kind of like that too during the Verge years as well. And then coming to Seattle is pretty different. It's, you know, there's one series in Bellingham, one series in Seattle. And then I think in Spokane, there's an existing series too. But it was time for something new. And Terry and I think, hit it off really well and both saw like what cross could be like in Seattle for the next decade.
So what's the evolution just from starting up MFG to getting it to the level where you're having these UCI races and sort of these big draws in here and some of the biggest races in the country for that time?
I mean, I think our goals were kind of, we had two separate goals, and I think that's what is important. We, you know, when Zach and I started talking about this, and it's something that Zach really pushed, he's like, we want to make this as accessible as possible. We want to make cross as easy as it can be to join in and be a part of. And so we took a different approach by running non-sanctioned events within the MFG series. And then we also really wanted to try to work hard to find venues that were close in to the I-5, well, not really the I-5 corridor, but our corridor basically from kind of north suburbs of Seattle to south suburbs of Seattle. So from basically Tacoma, where we had nationals, north of Seattle up to Everett, and like no further east than basically the suburbs of Seattle. And so we were saying like, let's get these races back into the urban areas, because generally people were taking the path of least resistance and doing these races in more, you know, kind of rural areas. So that was really what was the push with MFG Cyclocross, was to make it feel friendly, to make the registration process straightforward and nice, and make people feel good about being there. Make it so that you could have spontaneous racing happen. Like if someone's in a park with their kid and they've got a mountain bike and they're like, what's going on here? And oh, there's a junior race at noon, I can send my kid up. That could happen. And it was happening early on. And again, just like, we have three races that you could commute to on your bike super easy now for people in that kind of Seattle metro area. So that was, you know, a big part of the push. And that was really independent of what we were doing that had anything to do with UCI events. The UCI thing was basically, you know, coming from the fact that Starcross was an existing property that I had been working on with the club. And then the thing got too big for the club to do, and it made sense for it to spin off and into the professional organization that we had established that was running MFG. And then, you know, so Starcross was this kind of one-off UCI event. Sometimes it early on had a partner or a sister race with Rad Racing GP, which was put on by Rad Racing as a separate promoting organization. And then it got to the point where personally with some things that were going on with the executive director of Rad Racing. They just couldn't do it anymore. And so then that's when we started to expand what we were doing beyond Starcross to develop a full weekend to support the Starcross weekend. And then in years in the future, you know, being involved with events that essentially by de facto kind of became test events for the Nationals course by bringing in events into Tacoma in partnership with Tacoma Sports Commission, because they had become motivated to work with us and help us as we essentially rescued the permits from the Bend UCI races one season when they became overwhelmed and had sponsorship issues. And we were just like, came in, and for some reason, Zach and I decided that in 6 weeks we could rescue those events and put them on. So then there was a continuation for a few years of using that South Puget Sound venues and Sports Silicon as a UCI event venue. So that's kind of what was going on there. And then at some point we just decided to focus more on the Nationals bid and then just our local series. So we've been kind of away from UCI for a few years.
How did the idea to have Nationals come up? And was this always something that you were thinking? I mean, that Stellacombe venue, of course, known from racing in the past with, okay, what's the name of the run? Is it Nap Time?
Yeah, that's the legendary run-up from the USGP days, and right. Then just also from the local events that have been promoted there in the past by other promoters, yeah.
Were more people upset or happy that that was not part of the Nationals course who had raced there in the past?
I think a lot of people, like generation-wise, probably might not have any connection to it, actually. And I was thinking back the other day, like one of the first events we put on in the era of MFG was a race that we called Cross Clash, where we kind of had a race between Washington riders and Oregon riders, and we used that venue. And I think the venue is being kind of used in the same way, using the Nap Time run, using remote sections of the park. And one of the tenets that had always guided our race was to make it more compact, centralize the energy, centralize how things race day flowed. And so we set up a pretty different course. And I think at first it was not well received, or it was skeptically received, because it was a different part of the park. It was faster. It was flatter in some ways. It wasn't as mountain bikey. But it's been really awesome to see the evolution at that park to how we have used it, how another local series, CXR, has used it, how some of the GPs still in, you know, in the late 2000s were using it. But it's, you know, I think it's a world-class course now, and it's very different. And nap time wasn't ever a part of it, primarily because it was just, you know, landscape to be a different use, but it was way out. And so to get out there, yeah, you had to go out and then come back. And so we've connected the park in a very different way. And it took a lot of work to get there. And, you know, Rich and Robert, who are part of our owners of MFG, definitely led the way in what the venue looks like now. So it's those guys who really saw opportunity. And when Micah and USAC did the course walk, yeah, and Keegan did the course walk, we were already basically presenting to them a course, obviously open to Keegan's expertise and his vision too. But, you know, Rich is so obsessed with setting up, even at our local races, a very balanced pit and, you know, taking a wheel and wheeling out, okay, pit one is here, pit two is here. And, you know, Cyclocross Magazine did a really good interview with Rich, but the course that he tries to set up at a local race, you know, a UCI race that we've done, or a national race, it's all the same principles in a lot of ways. Really fair racing, really challenging sections, fair start, fair finish. And I think that really all came together at Nationals. And it really was a decade of, you know, putting courses together and refining what could be done.
Yeah, even the thing that people take for granted and we haven't really seen in a couple of years is just a legitimate start and finish that was the that met the actual UCI requirements that, you know, in Louisville, yeah. As great as Louisville was, that didn't. That was a short, you know, start finish stretch there. But you guys had that huge run out, was great, you know, and then even off the start, a lot of time to kind of shake it out before that first run up was just really, it's those little things that I think really came together well.
Yeah, and you know, like sometimes you know, life is so much about luck. I mean, they basically like 2 years ago had a plan to bring in a new 8-inch water line into the park, and they had to rip up the whole existing street, which was totally potholed, and we would race on it, but it was like, you know, you had to keep your eyes open. And so the fact that we basically had like sidewalks and fresh pavement and all that stuff for nationals was just like a total like luck moment. And it, you know, it just elevated the event, and it was really awesome to be able to do that. Now then circling back to just the motivation for trying to bring nationals to Washington, I think it was, you know, it was a part of all of us in our organization's desire to, reward the community for being so awesome in terms of their support of cross. You know, we will have weekends where we have over 1200 people racing, and an MFG race. And it just seems like a community that needed to have the event in its backyard. And so we always had in the back of our mind that we wanted to do it. And then the relationship that we had been building for, basically since about 2014 with the Tacoma Sports Commission just kind of really sealed it all up, because Dean Burke reached out to us and said, you know, we want to put a bid together and we want you guys to partner with us, and we want to use our expertise in the areas that we know, and we want you to use your expertise in cyclocross, and we want to put this bid together. And so, you know, Dean really pushed it and really motivated us to be involved. And I think without Dean's pushing and saying that he would do the hard work that we didn't want to do, the stuff that made me go, oh God, I don't know if I want to do this, you know, like that really helped. And their ability and willingness to take on some of the financial risks that there were things that I was just like, oh, I don't want to do this. They made the model work for us and them to do it. And I think, it's often that happens, because you get such an amazing push for your community out of holding an event with that much energy, for continuing the growth of your sport and in your community. You know, you'll have say 50 juniors who have never been to nationals before and may never have gone to nationals and would never go to a future nationals unless they have the ability to do it in their backyard. And now we have these people who are going to go to Chicago, and they're going to go to wherever the next one is after Chicago, because of they've had this thing happen for them in their community. And that's the same to be said for the Masters, and especially the Masters women, you know, to have that accessibility and that motivation to be involved. So it's just a really awesome shot in the arm for a scene. And we saw that as a way to, you know, reward and continue to build our community around cross.
So this is not a loaded question in any way, because I don't even know where I stand on this. But, you know, the Pacific Northwest, the no UCI races there for a number of years. Is this an incentive now to bring in to have a UCI weekend, or are you all happy with just the way things are going?
I think, you know, we've had some really solid conversations with people with great ideas on what the future looks like, some of whom are really good friends with you. I think the UCI model in general is pretty broken in terms of how you string it together in the US, how you make it sustainable year after year, when trying to find a sponsor is a huge part of that piece. I don't think we're against putting on UCI races. I think, you know, Terry and I and Rich and Robert have talked about some other concepts that would be cool to do in the next, you know, now that Nationals is over. But specifically UCI, like, I think it works well for some people. Like, Adam will put on his race forever in Massachusetts, and it works well for him. But I think we're interested in other ideas. And, you know, we like that high level of production. And we think we have a really solid venue and a solid partnership with the city and with the park. But you know, one of the challenges was with Marymore and where we had been putting on a UCI event was just the venue and who they have to be able to, on a moment's notice, pay a sort of a residency of a month to have the circus at Marymore. It's like, it's just a different economic model, and what they can ask right. and what they can get. So venue's pretty important to us, and we like to put on races where we believe the energy and the flow and the course will all work together. I think we have a place, but what the future holds is, you know, I think we have some ideas, we have some opinions, but I don't know if it's UCI.
I mean, I think we look at events that have, I don't know, cachet is the right word, but, you know, are significant on the calendar, and whether or not a standalone UCI event in Tacoma on a given weekend in October and November definitely is, without a national series being involved or whatever, I don't know if we feel like that has enough of kind of a milestone that we want to be involved in right now. But we do look at events like the Pan American Championships and that kind of an event as a natural next step for something for us to be involved with and use the venue that we use for nationals for an event like that. So we're definitely not going to be on the sidelines. But I think we're going to look at like more unique opportunities like that, than say like a, you know, ongoing on the calendar UCI event. And then, you know, maybe we can build towards blowing people's minds by bringing, you know, the world championships when I'm in my 60s, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, something like that, you know, like.
For sure. And that's kind of the, and one of the reasons I bring it up is almost selfish on my own part is that I loved going to nationals, but that's the first time I've been out there, you know, and the reason is that without that UCI draw for me, those aren't races that are going on my calendar, which means that to go along with what you're saying, yes, it's a broken system because I want to go to those races, and it's just trying to figure out a way that UCI doesn't rule everything. And maybe we can, you know, not have to have that for every race that means something in the country. I but again, I mean, we talk about it a lot, and I still don't really know where I come down on that.
Well, and I think that's what's one of the interesting like dynamics that's going on with like people's attention for events. I think that gravel and cross can and should live together in like a very synergistic way. Gravel should be growing cross because now people are by default buying a bicycle that is more versatile than they were previously. But I think it's interesting that there are events that are, again, like milestone events on the calendar that people can target and have the energy and the motivation to travel to, that don't have to do anything with UCI because of the reward that they offer. Like if you finish Dirty Kansas or Mid-South or, you know, whatever it is, Lost and Found, there's a part of you that just says, hey, I accomplished something and I pushed my body in a way that I wasn't sure I could do, or whatever that dynamic is. Whereas asking someone to travel, you know, on an airplane who's a grassroots racer to a 40-minute cross race, right, they know they're going to finish that 40-minute cross right. race. So something's got to happen at that 40-minute cross race that's like going to blow your mind in other ways. And that's a lot to ask of a promoter to go beyond, you know, putting on a good bike race, like whatever that would be, you know, like the circus is next door to it or something. But, yeah. you know, like,
yeah.
so I think that's something as cross promoters outside this whole UCI framework that's going to be interesting to address and something to learn maybe, I don't know, from the whole gravel thing. But so I think we're just like, we have 1,800 people in our community that want to race cross.
Right.
And we're just doing the best we can for those 1,800 people and keeping them stoked and wanting to be involved with what we're doing. And I think that UCI events aren't going to change their stoke. What's going to make their stoke the highest level is for us to put on six really fun events that are dynamic from year to year. So 1 year we're doing prizes in one way, and then the next year we're doing prizes in a unique way that they never ever thought of. That's going to be like, a carnival, or you're going to win points that are like tickets, and you're going to go buy your prizes at the end of the season with your collection of tickets that you got, like you're at the carnival. Doing those kinds of things is, I think, a better for us to keep the 1,800 customers that we have and then make that 2,000 or 2,500 customers. I think that's what we're kind of focusing on.
So six events, is it a Saturday and Sunday racing? So like 12 race series, or how does it work?
We're 6 weekends.
Okay.
We race Sundays on 6 weekends. And then okay. We have another series in the north, in the same kind of vicinity, that races 6 weekends as well. And we basically trade weekends with CXR. And so there's a dependable 12 races in the Puget Sound area. And then Bellingham, which is an hour and a half north of us, they have 6 events. And then there's some one-off events that people do.
And I like six. Which is, six is perfect.
Yeah, six is good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Eight is like just enough to make you want to pull your hair out. And six is enough that you're like, shit, the season's over. That was fun.
Yeah, and it's still, I think that, you know, we used to have these series that were like 12, 14 race weekends. And I don't know what changed in it, but this is when I was, you know, early 2000s, and everybody was into that. Every weekend, you points and series points and being in a series, and it was very important, and you went to everything. I feel like how people race now has changed, where that's either not as important, or the attention span has like dropped, or just the want to race that long of a season. But I think six, especially with having those different series available. Yeah, that's a nice setup. I can see where people would be into that.
So, Bill, I'll ask you a question.
Yes.
If in a six race series, do you think people should be able to drop their worst race?
No.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right. Here's a question for y'all. Because what I like about what you've done is that you've kind of jumped into everything. I mean, you had the Starcross. I do one thing that just sort of struck me is bringing up Johnny Sun. He seems like he is just popping up in all of these conversations that I have, be it East Coast, West Coast, wherever. So I think I may have to talk to him soon.
Yeah, Johnny will be entertaining for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, oh, I know. Yeah. But one of the things I was just quickly looking through, because I knew Starcross, knew, you know, USGP at Stellicom.
Are you talking about the North American Cyclocross Trophy?
Yeah. Yeah. That came yeah, into yeah. that. That's just, what? Yeah, just what, I mean, that,
together?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like this forgotten little piece of history for US Cyclocross.
Well, Miles Roganow, is that how you say Miles' last name?
It's Romanoff, yeah.
Romanoff, yeah. So there was this period of time, I think, where there was some backlash going on against the USGP by lots of different groups, promoters, riders, different things going on. And I had always viewed Starcross as a really high quality event, but there was really no room for it in the USGP, and I didn't necessarily want to be in the USGP. That they have their own model and they have their own thing, and we had been approached by them at times to like to help them have an event in Seattle. But just looking at the way it worked, it wasn't something that we were interested in. So anyways, I'm like loading my family up. I think my kids are like, maybe my oldest boy is 7 or 8. And we're loading up the car to like go away for Memorial Day weekend or something. I don't know. And I get this phone call. It's like New York on my phone. I'm like, what is this? Answer. This is how most of this crap happens, it seems like, in my life. And he's like, hey, this is Miles. I put on the Super Cross and I want to put on a national series that's going to kick this, the, you know, USGP's ass or something, you know?
And you, like, you even censored Miles' languages significantly, even in that statement.
Yeah. And I'm like, cool. I've always wanted to be involved with the national series. What's your idea? He's like, well, you know, he just, blah, 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 blah. And one of the things that's unique about Miles is he can like type 200 words a minute. So he'll send you these emails that are just like this, like crazy, like, you know, just stream of consciousness. So I'm like, I'm interested. Send me some information. We'll talk. And so, you know, he basically said, there's these events that occur. They're not in the USGP. They're not in the national series. They have a high level of recognition, which was at the time like the Boulder event. And that was right when Cross Vegas was starting, but it wasn't, you know, at the level where it was going to become a World Cup. You know, it was like a year or two old. of course, Miles Race had to be in it because it was his idea to put the series on. There was Gloucester. And so he just kind of like picked these people, and somehow we all basically got on conference calls and figured out how to put a national series together. And some people took leadership in it and did a lot of work, and some people just put their races on and were part of it. And it was what it was. It was super fun to be involved with, and it had all the challenges of basically like bringing, you know, four promoters together and trying to cooperate to produce something. But it was great to have Brooke involved. Brooke Watts was involved in it, and he was, you know, a real backbone of getting shit done. And we did what we did. I still think it has the best logo, and that was basically just a guy that I knew in Seattle who was working for an advertising agency. He's like, "Oh, dude, we'd be stoked to make a logo." And they just sat down and made an awesome logo. And so, yeah, it just kind of came together. And I think the writers appreciated it.
Yeah.
I think Tim summed it up perfectly when you interviewed him a couple weeks ago. Like, it had its strengths, it has its weaknesses. And the bottom line is that you, to do something really well, like a national series, there has to be like centralized leadership that's telling you exactly what you're doing in terms of appearances and backdrops and protocols for podiums and, you know, all that stuff. So it looks the same.
Right.
You know,
for sure. Yeah.
But I like the fact that we had different promoters involved and they had the freedom to put on their events and the way they put them on. So,
right. And that was the difference. That was the difference between that and the USGP, which was one promoter and the,
Yeah. And with the USGP, and I think the strength of the USGP and the way that that was organized and the way that any national series should be organized is that the bullhorn is coming from one place. So that it's like, hey, look at us. This is what we're doing. Cyclocross is awesome. National cyclocross is awesome. Jeremy Powers versus Tim Johnson is awesome. That's a lot easier to do when you're a centralized organization than like, you know, each individual promoter, because they're really just going to push the message to their community, get them out for a race. It's harder to create that modern term of a narrative across the nation when you kind of have people cooperating with each other. So, you know, USGP was Safeway, and North American Cyclocross Trophy was like a cooperative grocery store organization that helped each other, but, you know, still had to make sure that their groceries were fresh at their store.
So 2008, how long did it go, more than 1 year, or was it just...
We had, I think, 3 years.
3 years. Okay,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
And then we got shut down because we broke the rules. So none of us knew that we had to inscribe with the UCI.
Oh, so you all got... Okay. All right. It's all coming back now. Yes. Got it.
So we just like threw this thing together by a seat of our pants first year, second year, kind of the same thing. And then after the third year, basically a letter came from the UCI saying that this wasn't legal. You didn't inscribe this series, blah, 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 blah. So that's how it kind of came to an end.
Yeah. It's interesting. Okay. No, that all makes sense now. Cause that was the same year that, like Mid-Atlantic Cyclocross also got sort of dinged for, I think they had too many races.
I think USGP was inscribed properly.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if the Verge series was or not. I feel like the Verge series had to take 1 year off and then they came back.
Yeah. There was something going on either with the number of races they had, or it might have even been that they had their amateur races as part of the state where it wasn't split out from the pro rate. Yeah, there was something going on there. Yeah, yeah.
And it was one of those classic things where like USA Cycling like tries to have like these summits and everyone talks about best practices, and like there's this best practice that you need to like inscribe your series, and nobody's sharing that information. So those best practices conversations never are as robust as they should be, I guess.
So, Zach, tell me about nationals. Now that's all sort of died down, what's your biggest takeaway?
I was riding the rollers the other night. I was telling Terry today, I was riding the rollers and I have the link on my browser, and I was watching races that I hadn't seen. Like I watched the junior race. And it was just, it still blows me away. The level of cooperation, I think, would be one of the biggest things that I took away. So to make an event like this work, Like Terry was saying, the community punched in a huge, huge way. And we were pretty organized, and we identified people in the community who could be counted on as leaders to help manage the volunteers, to help manage, you know, the junior party, help manage the beer garden. And at no time was it feeling like competitive. Like, everybody from the community came together to because they knew what had to be done, and everyone was motivated. To see that in conjunction with, I have a very different opinion of USAC now that I've worked side by side with them. And so I think over the years, you know, we've had a very singular relationship with USAC. We pay our permit fee when we do use them, and we are a sanctioned race. We do our post-event paperwork. We deal with the officials on site, and it's a very one-dimensional way of working with that organization. And I think we came in, I'll speak for myself, I came into the two-year run with a preconceived notion of how it was going to be to work with USAC. And I think I came out of it with a very different perception. They work extremely hard. The people who are on the ground producing the event, we have way more in common, I think, with those folks than anyone we've ever worked with at USAC from like an officiating or office standpoint. But for me, seeing that element of the communal piece to put it all together, it was super, super cool.
I mean, just to understand how much more respect Zach has for the USA, the USA CYPA now, he calls it USAC instead of the feds.
You know, so I like that.
We were getting busted on regular during conference calls for 2 years, and he's finally got it down so that now he knows it's USAC, not the feds. So
I kind of like that. So here's my question for you. You have that whole Hodala crew who sort of took over the middle of your venue. What's the relationship with there? Were they and were they just?
We don't know who they are.
We do not. We've never talked to them.
I think it summarizes what I was just mentioning about the community coming together. So, Their ringleader Sally has been a staple in what we have done as an organization for 10 years.
From the very beginning, he was like the first person to call us up when we released details on the series.
For sure.
Like, what can I do? How can I be involved?
He was working at Raleigh, and so Raleigh was has been a title sponsor for MFG for many years. So he was side by side supporting what we were doing, and his only real ask was really like, you gotta let me have my play time when I come to your races. So, you know, when I show up and I pull my trailer in, I expect you to point me to where I get to go, and I'll tell you where I want to go, and you know, you'll both give me different answers, and then we'll figure it out. But you know, they definitely brought, I think, when everyone went away from Nationals and they talk about how it felt and what it felt like to race on that track and the vibe, it was a huge part of Hodala being centralized. And Terry and I were laughing because I think on one of your pods, there was this discussion of like, you know, was there an intentional reason that the beer garden was kind of close to this run up? And it's like, yeah, of course. Like, we had it so dialed. Like, we knew who was going to be there. We knew where the beer gardens were going to be. We knew where we wanted the energy. And Hodala was definitely part of adding fun and making people smile and really just making it feel authentic. I mean, it was authentic too. That's the coolest thing. It's like, they weren't being someone else. They're just being themselves. They were celebrating what they've been doing for the last 10 years and being part of the community. So,
oh yeah. I mean, from the bubble machine to the exercise bikes to the, you know, to them playing Sleep albums.
to their flag battle with Cross Crusade. I mean, like,
that was great. Yeah.
I mean, you know, so it was all great. And, you know, we've had basically 10 years of practice with those guys of establishing the limit and where they can go with the fun and where they can't go. And they bring great energy and they're super fun. And they're part of what I think makes Cross great. I think it's part of what makes the Northwest scene great is that people want to be themselves and they want to have fun and they want to celebrate the sport, and they want to race hard and they want to be bike racers, but they don't want to be serious all the time. And those guys, like, they've been coming to our events, like Zach said, for 10 years, and they'll take a section of the course and they'll make it super fun. And it's always cleaner when they leave than when they got there. And so it's just been awesome. It's been a really fun to have our own little contained group of hooligans that do such a great job. And, you know, it was fun to have them there, and they did an amazing job with what they did.
It was spearheading, like, the inclusion of Hodala. So, like, props to Tara for, like...
Tara, for those that don't know, is the national events manager at... vice president, excuse me, at USA Cycling.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so she had, like, three rules.
Yeah, it was funny because Brian showed up with the trailer, I think, on the Sunday before we started, or the Saturday, to get it positioned and dialed in. And she was like, okay, Terry, as soon as Brian gets here, I need to talk to him. I have three rules. And so when I said, well, what are the three rules? And so she tells me three rules, and I'm like, oh, man, this guy's reputation is way bigger than it really is. I was laughing because I'm like, she's like, well, one of the rules is they can't heckle juniors and women. And I'm like, that's fine. That's easy. The other one is they can't be drinking, you know, outside the beer garden. I'm like, okay, cool. We can handle that. And then she's like, and then the third rule is they have to keep their junk in their pants. And I'm like, what the heck are you? That's not going to happen. Like, we don't need that rule. You definitely think that these guys, their reputation is blown up bigger than it really is. So I can tell you that they followed the rules for the most part, but I can't tell you which rule they broke. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I did hear something about, you know, I think earlier in the week there was some back and forth about the volume of their music, and I think that quickly just disappeared by the time the weekend came around.
Yeah, I think there was definitely some concerns from USA Cycling production that their music might have not been being heard at the finish line because of music coming from some other part of the venue. But I think it definitely became like, oh, this is working, you know.
It was good. It was all good.
Yeah.
All right, so you've heard my conversations with Micah and Brad and Tim, and they all had these sort of behind the scenes stories of things that were near disasters or even in some instances full on disasters. Let's give me the dirt. What were the things that were like oh hell, this may not nationals? Happen, or any kind of stories like that from nationals?
Yeah. I had two memorable ones. I mean, and Terry, we can speak to the sandbag. I think that was definitely a memorable moment in midweek racing. But for me, I was there Sunday before the week started with my son, and we were setting up the expo, meticulously staking each little campsite. And one of the yard workers got his forklift stuck in the middle. Like, we specifically were not allowing vehicles in that area because we knew exactly what was going to happen. They were going to get stuck. And so this park employee,
maintenance guy,
had his forklift in the middle of expo area, and it was just stuck. 9-ton forklift. And he was sweating. And his solution was to get another forklift.
Oh, no.
And to have me drive it. And we were working cooperatively, like, with this push-pull sort of maneuver to get the forklift from the yard unstuck. And this is, like, beginning of the week. I'm like, oh, man, this is – here we go.
I think that was an hour and a half ordeal to get him out of there. Yeah. The other one was the day that most of the Masters men race, which I believe was Thursday. That was, like, kind of our worst weather day. It rained off and on pretty hard that day, and we had some high winds. And
yeah.
Sean Brett from USA Cycling calls on the radio. He says, I need all hands at the finish line. And he was kind of casual about it. He's kind of a pretty mellow dude. He's like, I need all hands at the finish line. And so I'm just kind of walking over there because he didn't have like this sense of urgency. And then I finally look up and the fencing basically on the kind of left-hand side corner as you left the pavement into the course off the finish stretch was dumped. And so now I'm like running over, and by the time I get there, they get it all up. There was about three or four guys in. They get it all up, and then so I walk back to the finish line where they have their trailer, and I'm behind a set of fencing that basically like corrals around their trailer. And Zach's with me suddenly. And all of a sudden I see this fencing start moving out into the course. That's the fencing on the, you know, on the course. And I'm like, Zach! And we start running for this fencing to grab it. And the next thing I know, this dude from Bend is behind us. He's racing and he's going behind butts. And we've now captured him in the fence. Like, he can't go anywhere. He's now off course. And we're like, shit. So he like gets out and gets back out of the pen. And luckily, you know, nothing hit him and everything. So we get the fence back. And I call Tara on the radio. I'm like, we got a problem. She's like, yeah, we do. So we were super lucky. If you remember those barns at the venue,
yes,
there was two pallets of sandbags that were the park sandbags. And we set down, I think, we set down 300 meters of additional sandbags. We were like every other sandbag on the fences, on their feet. And we set down 300 meter more in like 20 minutes in between races and during races. And that basically, secured the venue for the win the rest of the day. And you know, every night you get together after the races and you get together in the trailer, the ops trailer, and usually everyone's pretty tired and it's pretty quiet and you kind of just get the punch list for the next day and it's kind of like, okay, ready, break. Like that night, everyone was just like, wow, dang, dude, we kicked ass. And it was just like, I'm like, wow, everyone's got a lot of energy. And Tara's like, well, of course, we set down like 600 sandbags in like 20 minutes. Why wouldn't we be pumped? And, you know, I think that while I wouldn't have wanted that to happen, I think the energy from that really pushed us through those last 3 days, you know, because you're there, the people are there racing for 6 days and they're thinking it's a 6 day event, but you know, right, we've been at the venue for 2 weeks, you right, know, so, you know, by the time Sunday comes. So I think that event definitely, or that situation kind of pushed us through, and it definitely made the team consolidate together. You know, it's like, okay, this is a team.
That's awesome.
I think the other really funny thing to me was Keegan at some point decided that, I mean, you're on radio so much. And so Keegan decided that everyone had to have a nickname. And, you know, Rich and Robert were so instrumental to course repair, course setup. And, you know, they were, you know, working side by side with Keegan every step of the way. And that he had a name for Rich, which was Phoenix. It was just so fitting. And then Robert's was Goose, I think it was.
Yeah, it was Goose.
Yeah. Yeah. But just the fact that, I mean, Keegan is super funny. Like, I think when Keegan came in to inspect the course, we had, again, a perception of, you know, his setting up USGP courses and what he's done for other nationals. But he was awesome. Like, really funny guy, really mellow. I think he has a great vision of how he sees things and has some pretty different methodologies, but knowing that he's from Western Mass, and his dad was there his dad just came and was like hanging out and helping Ken.
Oh,
and
that's awesome.
Was super cool to see him just kind of punch in and be part of the team. But
I always like sort of walking the course with him, just because, especially, I was able to do it even before, as it was sort of going through his head in Louisville, and just all of the contingencies that he's thinking about the whole time while he's building a course is pretty neat, to be able to fix basically anything that may go wrong during the week that needs to be modified, which is sort of neat to see in person.
When we started live streaming on Saturday morning, it was pretty comical too, because, you know, this is the big show. USA Cycling wants everything to look perfect on camera. And they're trying to produce the best event or the best stream they can on Saturday, but it's not the primary thing. It's kind of the practice day, but it's awesome that they get to show all these junior races and all that. And so it might've been, I think it was actually Sunday morning. So then it's really game time. They want everything perfect. And 17, 18 boys are the first race off. So of course, you know, we've all watched races of any kind of bike race with 17, 18 boys. It's freaking mayhem and ridiculous, and they don't think they can die or get hurt. And so they launch out 95 17, 18 boys it's super aggressive. Everyone's fighting for the hole shot. They're all fighting to get up the first run up. And all of a sudden you have Tara on the radio, just like, blah, 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 course tape tore down here. Blah, 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 course tape tore down here. We have six poles down on corner 17. Da, 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 da. And I'm like, oh my God. And she's, and the direction she's giving us is that we need to fix this immediately because we want it to continue to look good. And I'm like, this is going to be a long day. And then Zach says to me, I bet you she's in the production trailer and is watching the cameras and is seeing everything that's getting broken on the screens. And so by the, you know, by Sunday, you've got your whole radio jargon down. I'm like, what's your 20, Tara? And she's like, I'm in the production trailer. And Zach's like, I told you. She's watching from the trailer and she's finding all the damage from the production trailer. Luckily, everything calmed down after that first lap with the 17, 18 boys, and the course wasn't getting torn down the entire day, so we didn't have to, you know, get direction from the eye in the sky, but it was pretty comical.
It was the feds watching you.
Yeah, the feds were watching us, yeah.
That's awesome. Sweet. Well, we are almost at about an hour. Anything else you guys want to, anything else you want to get out there, or just about cyclocross in general, the scene, or
I think we've covered lots of great stuff, and it's been a pleasure to be on, and you know, again, we just love to have the opportunity to talk about the West Coast cyclocross. I think sometimes nationally, I think what's going on out here gets forgotten a little bit. We've got awesome scenes all the way up and down the West Coast, so you know, anytime you want to talk West Coast vibes, we're here. So yeah, that's cool. And I think also, like, I think Cross is doing awesome. I think there's a lot of talk about it not being as awesome as it had been or something at one point. And I think we got to kind of, as a group, stop talking that way if we can, and just talk about what is good and what's going on. Because, well, I think, like, Zach and I can look at our numbers and we can see that things are plateauing. They've plateaued at a super healthy place. And right. I don't know if that's true for everybody in the country, but I mean, like, to be able to plateau at averaging like 850 racers at an event, I think that's pretty healthy. So
yep.
I'd love to trade. I would not trade my problem with some other people's other disciplines problems. So I think it'd be awesome to just, promote the idea that cross is still healthy and fun and people are doing it and they're loving it. So
I think that's right. And I think that, you know, and I'm as guilty as some, and I agree with you. And I've been trying to move myself into that direction, that we don't need all the hand wringing. Cause in the end we are in a good place, even if it isn't. My whole thing was that plateau and possible decline and other competition out there. But I do think you're absolutely right. If we look from, you know, 10, 15 years ago to where we are now nationally, the participation is still super high and at a good place.
What yeah, you can't be the fastest growing sport in America forever.
Yeah, know? Exactly. Exactly.
The curve's going to bend at some point, as they say.
Exactly. Zach, anything else to add?
Here's how you solve the national series dilemma. There's only two options. Option one, you decide as a country that the country is too big, which it is, to travel. And, you know, things, all the feedback about trying to get truck and trailer all across the country is a reality. So you decide that you're going to have residencies in all the hotbeds. So DC in 2021 is where everyone is going to be doing a residency. And your series and all the key races in DC, that's where all the best racers are. So it addresses where Katie's talking about Belgium on your pod, about being able to travel back and forth and having a home base. You eliminate all of that sort of logistic problems, and you recruit people to come to do a residency for a year in DC. Next year goes to Boulder. Next year goes to Vancouver, Seattle. And you have an agreed upon, like, here's where the residency for US Cross is going to be. And then you go from there. That's option one. Option two is, and again, listening to your podcasts were really helpful to think about this a bit. I think putting in bids hand in hand with sports commissions. So rather than trying to crack the code on title sponsors and how the series has a title sponsor, but every race promoter has their like maybe competing or non-competing sponsor, you have to put a bid in, just like nationals, in conjunction with the sports commissions. And we could name all the sports commissions that are, you know, have backing. So whether it's Bend or Asheville or Louisville or Lakewood, I mean, you go to, you work with USAC to put on a national series. Potentially they are definitely authoring it. But part of it, the bid process, is that you have a sports commission hand in hand. You would address all the pieces that Micah was talking about of trying to find, you know, the tier two city that's really motivated to work as a partner with you. And you create a deck from this series that is stronger than any deck that you've ever put together for one event, because it's now six sports commissions. And you're going to bat together with sports commissions. Like, has anyone ever decided to, like, hey, let's talk to all the sports commissions and get them talking to bring the production level from a, you know, live stream point of view where it was this year, to Brad's point in his pod with you, having a centralized place to store, you know, all the content, you know, at CX Airs or whatever it is. I don't necessarily think it's USA Cycling. I don't know, maybe, but you really try to incorporate sports commissions as the viable financial piece, because I think they are motivated to find quality events, to have data drive what they're doing. And then you have six cities. I mean, Asheville, Louisville, Bend, Boulder, I mean, Arkansas. I mean, you have all these places. Yeah, you have all these places that I think you likely have a strong sports commission that is motivated to bring people in. And
yeah,
I don't know. It was something that popped in my mind after listening to Micah.
Those are both great ideas. The residency one, that's a whole new approach. I love that. That'd be
super cool. Like, not everyone, like, juniors can't quit school, right? Like, there's obviously logistical problems, but like, how many people are trying to make cross like a living? You know, like, you got McTubbin living in his van and he's going to go where he's going to go. But it's like, yeah, you're living in Northampton for the fall, or you're living in Sacramento. Like, it would be super cool because everyone would be really, really psyched to be around each other, like, for all these races. Like, I think it could work, but
yeah. And then you even get, I mean, the other part about that whole Belgian equation is, you know, when they're all at that one forest, and, you know, you've got one guy interviewed and you look over his shoulder and there's like the Telenet team up there, you know, doing the same training in the same place, and everybody's all together.
Yep.
I like that idea. That's pretty awesome.
Creates that legacy thing that Nationals creates. So then you have this community that gets like 6 weeks of awesome racing, and then they just get totally hooked on the vibe of cross, and then that buoys them for like 4 to 6 years because they had the residency program in their town or in their region. And then it moves to the next place and it creates, you know, great energy in that community for the next season. And suddenly cross is, you know, super strong because all these different regions have had this really high level intensity going on for an entire season around them. And that stuff lasts for quite a while, you know, like, it really is infectious for a number of years.
Well, thank you so much for chatting this evening. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks for having us. It's really fun.